Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. It's been a stormy night across the plains, from a severe weather system which stretches from North Texas to Chicago, Nebraska, slammed by several likely tornadoes.
We have crews dispatched to the hardest hit areas right now. They're going to be putting together a strategic plan for a detailed search of the area, starting with the properties with the most damage.
Omaha Fire Chief Kathy Bossman. Donald Trump's hush money trial resumes Tuesday. Among the witnesses to testify today, the former president's former assistant, Rona Graff, who told the jury that he kept records on porn star Stormy Daniels, whom he's accused of paying $130,000 to keep her quiet before the 2016 election. The Pentagon says the largest military aid package so far is headed to Ukraine. The FAA wants to know why the emergency slide fell off a Delta Boeing 767 after it took off from New York's JFK. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Donald Trump campaigns in Wisconsin next week, which suits Wisconsin Democratic Party Chairman Ben Wickler just fine.
The more they find out what Donald Trump is promising to do to Americans if he wins again, the more voters move towards Democrats.
Republican Chair Brian Schimming says President Biden visits Wisconsin so often because he's in trouble here.
It's not because they're confident in Wisconsin. It's because they know they're in trouble in Wisconsin. There's no doubt about that.
The two spoke at a WISC Politics luncheon Thursday. Four Wisconsin technical colleges will use $75,000 to train young firefighters. The Youth Volunteer Firefighter Training Program aims to boost recruits for rural volunteer fire departments. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on Lake Air 107.5 FM and 1260 AM WLAK. And on the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I'm sure you saw yesterday the Biden folks rolled out, another $6.1 billion in support for reshoring manufacturing, some chip manufacturing, because, hey, we need chips. We need lots of them. And not the kind that we eat, but the kind that go into our smart thingies. The things that make our smart thingies smart? You know, those things that we kind of allowed other countries to kind of dominate. We're now saying, hey, we're going to be the leader, the global leader in this. And on Thursday, the administration announced this Micron project, $6.1 billion, going to go into building a memory chip factory in Idaho. That will come online in 2026. Two factories in Clay, New York. And then evidently two more will be built with private money, no CHIPS money on this. This is all part of the 2022 CHIPS and Science Act that Democrats and Joe Biden got through. And understand, this isn't the only ones. You've got that big one that's going to go out in Ohio with Intel. Intel's also building one in Arizona. TSMC's building another one in Arizona. Samsung's got one planned for Texas. There are others across the country that are propping up. So we will be the global leader in chip manufacturing. And I got this thought, you know, that giant stupid thing that, you know, Joe Biden did that. Yeah, Joe Biden did this. And thank you, Joe Biden, because the future is all about these chips. The future is about sustaining your ability to innovate, having control of your own data and technology. And I think, and you know, the pandemic really accelerated what we've been talking about on this show for decades, which is if you're not a producer, you're dependent. If you're not a manufacturing country, if you're not making stuff, you're at the mercy of someone else. And this has always been my argument, always been my argument. Once you give away your productive capacity, once you give away your manufacturing base and the brains that go with it, understand, we have had a massive brain drain over the last, you know, 20 years, 30 years in manufacturing. People that can take a chunk of something and turn it into something, wood, steel, whatever, turn it into something valuable. We're losing that. And the reality is, you know, part of it was by bad policy. Part of it was, you know, we just got complacent. And a big part of it was bad policy. Did I mention bad policy? Because all of the things that we're suffering under right now, bad policy did. So for me, the idea that we can undo bad policy with what? With good policy. Like, I think reinvesting in chips capacity, I think that's extraordinarily important. Not just because I want cheaper iPhones or I want, you know, to have iPhones or widgets or gizmos, but from a national security standpoint. And again, I've had a bunch of people say, well, you know, you're xenophobic because you're against the Chinese. I'm not against the Chinese. I'm against the Chinese communist government. Maybe it's the era of which I grew up, but I don't know. I still have a problem with the communists. I just do. You know, as my laptop says, you know, the Chinese communist government, right to work state since 1949. Not in favor of them. Which, interestingly enough, weirdly enough, today, my daughter had a question from one of her classes, you know, asking for them to go home and interview their parents or their grandparents about what it was like during the Cold War. And, you know, I said, look, you know, I grew up in an industrial center. Cleveland, Ohio was an industrial hub, steel mills and auto plants and, you know, manufacturing out the you know what. And again, this is back in the 70s, early 80s. And I grew up knowing that we were in an industrial hub. We were one of the first strike places. If there was ever going to be us bombing each other, Cleveland would be on the top of the list of places that an enemy would target because of its manufacturing capacity. And I said, look, you know, we also knew that there would be mutual assured destruction. If one did it, the other one would retaliate and everyone would be screwed. So you kind of took some solace in that. But also that, you know, being in a place of first strike capacity, you knew you weren't going to, it would be quick. You would be annihilated quickly, so you wouldn't suffer, I guess. And my daughter's like, oh my God, that's terrible. That's the world in which we came from. But we had that manufacturing prowess. And it got me to thinking of where we are. And understand, this is where my mind comes from. I'm a firm believer in strength through power. Silent power, but I'm big on make your stuff home. Make sure you're strong at home. That's how you keep the peace, not by continuing to give away. You know, we were sold on this idea, you know, from the Reagan era forward, Bill Clinton part of it too, that, you know, nations that trade with each other, you know, they don't go to war. That's, we now find out that's nonsense. I never bought it because eventually, what has happened, you've hollowed out our base. Now, fortunately, we've awakened from the pandemic, and we're rebuilding some of this, but it's going to take a bit. And I'll tell you, this guy, Joe Biden, this Biden, he did that. He started to bring back manufacturing, and I hope in November people give him the credit for that, because they've done some of it. Now, it's not going to ever come back the way it was when I was a kid. This idea that a factory is going to employ, you know, 50,000 people, that's not going to happen. But being able to control your own means of production for any nation is, well, it's paramount that you're able to do that. And he's moving us in that direction. Also, on Thursday, the Biden folks, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, voted to restore... what was that thing, that net neutrality thing? The FCC, I mean? and the FTC, the vote there, so that Comcast and Verizon, they don't get to keep feeding you stuff that they want to feed you instead of what you're looking for. It drives me crazy. I'll Google something, or I'll use one of the search engines to find something, and I've got to scroll through 10 things that they think I want instead of what I actually want, because they're getting paid for the other ones. I think you need to have net neutrality. That is a good thing. Joe Biden did that. And remember, you know, this week we talked about the fact that overtime is being expanded to millions of workers over the next several months because of the raise of the threshold that would give someone the ability to be tax exempt or overtime exempt. You know, management. They also banned non-competes. They're going after junk fees and late fees. They're doing all kinds of really great stuff. Stuff that you go, you know, maybe that's important. And look, we don't hear about any of this stuff. The mainstream corporate-controlled media has been feeding us a steady diet of Donald Trump, which is why I think it's important I point this out. Now, today on the program, we're going to talk about the week that was. Because, look, Trump and all of his legal wranglings have taken all of the air out of out of our media. And look, I get it. You know, people want to know what's going on. I hope people are paying attention. But this is important, too. What this administration is doing is nothing short of historic. They are setting the table for a positive future so that my kids might have a shot at something. That my kids might actually, inherit something worth inheriting. You know, I saw this this report from, I'm sure everyone knows who Mike Rowe is. He's the dirty jobs guy. But he said, look, you know, and I love the fact that he's not beating up on Gen Z. He said, look, you know, Gen Z is going to be the tool belt generation. And I agree. They're the people who are going to have to clean up the mess. I've been saying that for a while. They're the people who are going to have to undo all of the damage. All of this stuff is going to be in their laps. And that's what I've been telling my son. I go, reality is, you're cleaning up the mess, buddy. Get it the best education you can. Learn the most trade you can, because you're going to be the one who has to rebuild it. And in what way do we rebuild it? That's the question. You know, do we do it with low-road employers and desperate conditions and poverty wages, or do we do it with good wages, good benefits, good working conditions? Sunday is Workers Memorial Day. It's the day where we remember the workers who died on the job. They woke up that morning. They brushed their teeth. They had their breakfast. They did whatever it is they do. They got to work. And they didn't go home. And most working people know someone that this has happened to. I know several. That over my 35 years in the trucking business, yeah, sadly, I know people who didn't go home. And, you know, April 28th is kind of an important day for me, because I've had friends who have been killed on the job. In fact, I can't go past a couple of places on the highway here locally without thinking about them, because it's the place where they died. So for me, April 28th is an important day, which also brings out the AFL-CIO's death on the job report, which pointed out in 2022, you had 344 people who got up that morning or afternoon. They did their thing. They got in the car. They drove to work. And they did not get to come home. 344 each and every day from hazardous working conditions. That's 5,486 for the year here in the country. And they estimate that 120,000 workers die from occupational illnesses. That's stuff that you've been exposed to over the course of years. The cancers from, you know, from various chemicals and all of the things that happen in that way. They say the fatality rate, has risen to 3.7% per 100,000 workers, which, you know, you go, wow, that's better than it used to be 100 years ago. Yeah, it is. But still, I guess, unless you're one of those 3.7. Oddly, obviously, the low-wage workers are the ones who suffer the most. Black and Latino workers, they suffer the highest rates of dying on the job. Not surprisingly, because they do the most dangerous jobs generally. Employers reported, 3.5 million work-related injuries and illnesses. Again, another increase over the previous years. And look, I would argue that a lot of this is residual from the things that Trump did and the laxing of regulations and safety standards that happened with his NLRB and his Department of Labor. There are consequences to Republicans being in control of government. One of those things is much more dangerous workplaces. One of those things are lax enforcement of regulations and things that keep people safe. So don't be surprised, you know, when things get worse, when you have Republicans in office. The rate of serious workplace injuries because of violence also increased, 4.3 per 10,000 workers. The kind of injuries that have happened, 28% are repetitive use injuries, which, you know, I go back to again, and I hate to keep hammering on this, but Republicans, I keep saying, hate working people. Look at what they do and have done. If you remember, it was the George W. Bush years where they did away with being able to claim repetitive work injuries. Sorry that, oh, well, you know, I once had someone told me, well, you've got arthritis. Work doesn't cause that. I go, yeah, but years of injury and years of work does. Thought? Now, they also say in the report that workplace injuries and illnesses are underreported. They say the number is actually somewhere between 5.6 and 8.4 million, not the 3.5 million that have been reported. Chemical exposures still at the top of the game there. In plaguing workers and creating life-threatening and debilitating illnesses. The cost, they say, of all these injuries and illnesses, $174 billion to $348 billion a year. And that, they even say, is undercounting the number. That's not even, you know, talking about what happens to the families through lost income, through lost, you know, breadwinners, to the communities where that money doesn't reverberate through, to society as a whole, where you have these problems. Now, not surprisingly, the states that have the lowest union density rates generally have the higher death on the job rates. Right-to-work states, right up there. You got Wyoming, North Dakota, Mississippi, New Mexico, West Virginia, Louisiana. Those are your big ones. Wyoming, 12.7 per 100,000 workers killed on the job. And understand, we just don't have the resources to inspect. And I talked about this the other day. It would take 186 years for the federal OSHA folks to inspect every workplace in this country. And as this report points out, there are only 853 federal inspectors. And that's to inspect, 11.5 million workplaces? That is crazy. Between the state and the federal OSHA inspectors, you have 1,875. That is one inspector for every 80,000 workers. And you go, that seems like a lot. I don't know how you get there. They also point out that the budget OSHA has amounts to about $3.93 available to protect each worker. Doesn't seem like a lot. And they point out the penalties, and I've talked about this quite often. The penalties are pathetically low, something we should be really complaining about, especially when, you know, someone comes to this country and works in the fields, dies of heat exposure, and the company's fined, was it 25 grand? Crazy. But they say that the average penalty for a serious violation, about $4,500. The average penalty on the state level, about $2,400. And the median penalty for someone dying on the job for federal OSHA, 14 grand. On the state level, 7 grand. Yeah. Understand, only 137 worker death cases have been criminally prosecuted in this country since the Occupational Safety and Health Act was enacted in 1970. Let that sink in for a minute. It's crazy. But there you have it. And for me, the way we solve this, The way we fix these situations, we let workers join and form unions to keep themselves safe. Because as I've said, I've never taken an unsafe truck on the road because I've always had the power to say no. I've always had the power to say, fix it. I'm not moving it. Every worker should have that power. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Reed Galen's going to be here to share some thoughts on the week that is Trump. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this week, 18 people were indicted in Arizona. The fake elector thing. Yeah, the little scheme that they had going on. 11 of the people who were the fake electors and seven of Trump's advisors, including one, Christina Bob, who you may remember last month was appointed to be the, what was it? The election integrity officer there at the RNC. Oh, what fun, what entertainment. Look, you know, not a great week for Donald Trump because in that case, he was named an unindicted co-conspirator number one, also in Michigan for the same thing. He's in the Manhattan courtroom doing that thing. He's got the Supreme Court thing that happened. Lots of things going on in Trump's world, and here to share some thoughts on the circus that has become our politics. I've asked Reed Galen to come talk with us. Reed is the chief cook and bottle washer over at the Lincoln Project. Reed, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, great to be back.
So, not a great week for our whiner in chief. Because I got to tell you, all I keep hearing is complaining and whining. You know, for a wannabe dictator, sure seems kind of whiny.
Yeah, but this is part of the nature of this kind of individual and this kind of movement, which is the ultimate victimization. We should remember that everything that's happening right now are because of the things that he did or the people around him believed he wanted done. And so we should never remember, Rick, that you and I wouldn't be having any of these conversations about New York or Arizona or about the Supreme Court today, but for this man's actions.
Let's talk about Arizona for a minute because, you know, it's not just this Christina Bob, but you also got Mark Meadows, Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, John Eastman, Boris Epstein. You got a bunch of the key folks there. This is kind of a big deal, especially coming out of Arizona.
Yeah, I think it is. And also remember that there's no federal protection should he win in November. So these are all people that are likely to see pretrial motions and potentially depositions and discovery and everything else. And so, you know, look, I think the Attorney General of the state of Arizona is likely to really go forward with this. And these people now all have more mounting trouble. And it's not just legal, Rick. It'll also be financial. And I think that a lot of these people, like we've seen probably in Georgia and probably in Washington, D.C., are going to go looking for as much immunity as they can possibly find.
Speaking of immunity, the Supreme Court this week heard the case that Trump was trying to make that he should be immune no matter what. You know, the whole idea that, you know, the president, if the president does it, it's not illegal. In my mind, as I listen to the oral arguments, I'm going, if I'm Joe Biden and this goes Trump's way, maybe we take him out.
Well, look, I think that's the fundamental difference. You just hit the nail on the head, is that there's one person who wouldn't do that and another one who already tried. I think that the arguments, to the extent that I have heard them, were concerning. I think that they were frustrating for many people, and I certainly understand all of that. But I think at the end of the day, Rick, this is why November is going to be that much important, much more important, excuse me, is that if we want this to end anytime soon, it's going to have to be at the ballot box. We should not count on any court to do us any favors between now and November 5th. It's going to have to be on election day.
Because it seems to me, and maybe you can help with this, because I'm struggling. You hear all this stuff coming out about what this guy did and what his underlings did, and yet it doesn't appear from the polling that it's really hurt him all that much.
No, well, I mean, I think this is why these things matter on the margins, Rick, is that with his base of support, let's say that's 40% right now, right? Let's say there's 40% of the country that's going to go for him no matter what. That's probably true. But, you know, there's another 6 to 8% that he can't live without, that I think are maybe really questioning where they want to be in this world. I think he can't probably get past 46 nationally. So I think he's in a lot of trouble anyway. And I think that any conviction and frankly, more time off the road is bad for him. I know that, you know, there are competing theories that, you know, making Trump a victim, yada, yada, yada. But as I said at the top, you know, these are actions he's taken and the facts of these cases are really not in dispute in any place, right? This is not a he said, she said thing. I mean, literally, he did these things, all of the things that he'll ultimately go to trial for. So I think that you could see a lot of independents just get turned off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I look here in my state of Pennsylvania. We just had our primary this week. And, you know, it's a closed primary. So Republicans voting for Republicans, Democrats voting for Democrats. And Nikki Haley pulled 157,000 Republicans. She didn't run an ad, run a campaign. She didn't do it. She's been out of this thing for weeks. And yet she got 157,000 Republican votes.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. She's been off the trail. She's been out of the race for, what, 7 weeks at this point? And also, I would say, Rick, the most important thing about those votes is really where they were clustered. And it's all around those collar counties of Philadelphia, as you know, that are swing counties every time. They're purple every time. And that's where you're seeing a lot of Republicans state dissatisfaction with their option in Trump. This is not good news for him. His coalition has not expanded, and I don't see it expanding between now and, you know, this fall.
It's going to be interesting to see where this goes. Now, have you been following the Manhattan trial, where you had David Pecker be the first guy to testify? And, you know, the thing that's getting a lot of attention is, you know, the fact that Pecker said, yeah, we haven't spoken, but I still consider him a friend, which I find kind of interesting.
Look, I have been doing everything I can, Rick, honestly, to stay away from that. Because, you know, I have a habit of looking at local newspapers, whether or not it's the Milwaukee, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or the Philadelphia Inquirer, or the Pittsburgh Post, I actually call it the KC Star test. And the truth is, much of this isn't really filtering down into the states where, frankly, this election is going to be focused and where I spend all my time. And so, you know, look, I think for him being off the road, being unable to raise money, being unable to campaign, and frankly, looking sleepy and gray and everything else, I think is far more effectual for individual voters in states than it is what David Pecker said about anything, to be honest with you.
No, that's a good point. On the immunity part, you know, having heard the oral arguments, where do you see that going?
You know, I'm not enough of a scholar to know this stuff. I'm a little concerned that there's enough of these justices. Look, it's a 6-3 court. That are going to give him enough of an out on enough stuff that, you know, it'll be probably, you know, a reduced prosecution. But the same time, you know, he's going to be in a federal courtroom, again, not on the trail. And this isn't going to be like New York, Rick. This is going to be a bunch of people that work for him going, that guy told me to do it. That guy told me to do it. And I think that's going to, I mean, not to say that you could really understand the man's mental state at any given moment anyway, but I think that it's concerning from a perspective of jurisprudence and rule of law. I think that the justices probably would love to be rid of him, because the first thing authoritarians love to do is get rid of courts that can tell them what they can and can't do. And so I think it's a wake-up call that if you're not worried about what's going to happen if this guy wins, you should probably get ready for it.
Yeah, let's flip to the other side. You know, Biden's fighting, you know, getting out, doing a lot of things popping up now, some good stuff coming out of the Federal Trade Commission, the FCC, bringing back net neutrality. There's a lot of things happening. It seems like all the noise, all of the air is being sucked out by Trump. Will any of this stuff filter into the people that you're talking to? Will they see that the things have gotten done, and will Biden's message get through?
You know, it should. There's really no excuse for it not to work, right? They have the White House, they have the entire federal government at their disposal, and they're going to have a couple of billion dollars. If people aren't hearing about this, if individual voters aren't hearing about it, it's because they're not listening, A, or they're not being told loud enough. And A is a direct function of B. And so I think that the president's campaign, the cabinet, everybody that can needs to be screaming this stuff from the mountaintops. I think that, you know, the stuff that they're taking activist positions on, whether or not it's the FTC or the airline rules, right, for folks who, you know, listen, we've got summer vacation coming up, people are going to be stuck at airports. I think these things matter individually because it says this is a guy who's here for me, not just for himself.
There you go. Reed, I appreciate the time. Always good talking with you. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thanks, Rick.
Reed Galen, chief cook and bottle washer there at the Lincoln Project. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Few showers and storms tonight and breezy. Temps steady to slowly rising through the 50s. Lingering drops tomorrow morning, mostly cloudy, mid-60s for tomorrow afternoon. More rain around Sunday, breezy and low 60s. Rain chances linger into Monday morning and cool, only upper 50s. Currently, it's 47 degrees.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I went to go see The Queen of My Dreams, which is a beautiful film about a mother-daughter relationship. So funny, so beautiful, so heartfelt. Would highly recommend it.
And that concludes our Monday morning segment of Here's How Pat Kreitlow is an Uncultured Slob. You are cultured, man. You are a big old cup of yogurt over there. I mean, we're talking some fruit on the bottom over there.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, interesting week, as I said earlier, interesting week in Trump world. The circus known as Trump world. Like I said, you know, Arizona and Michigan named as unindicted co-conspirator number one. Good on him. I guess this is one more legal headache he doesn't have to deal with. He's got what's going on in Manhattan, that happening, which evidently you've got the prosecutor saying, you know, Trump's continually breaking the gag order. You got the thing with E. Jean Carroll. He was seeking another election. That didn't happen. The Supreme Court. Having his hearing on whether he can actually shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And look, if I'm Joe Biden, I'm watching this closely. Like I said earlier, I'm watching this closely. But here to share some thoughts on the week that was, the insanity. Oh, the entertainment, at least the entertainment value of it. I've asked our good friend Sarah Burris to come talk with us. Sarah's a reporter at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I got to tell you, I haven't been spending a lot of time on talking about anything going on in Trump world. So I'm going to need you to catch us up because I've just kind of stepped back and gone, this is almost surreal. And, you know, a guy who wants to be a dictator just seems to be so whiny. I mean, it's this grievance, whiny, complaining. I can't take it anymore. I mean, you know, he used to be entertaining. Now it's just kind of sad.
Yeah. And honestly, things were a little bit quiet early in the week because it was still jury selection and then opening statements. And then Wednesday they're off because the judge has another court that he presides over for mentally ill defendants. Bless him. And so it was relatively quiet. And then all of a sudden it was like, boom, like everything just sort of happened. And it started really with the idea of, that they are indicting a whole lot of folks in Arizona for the fake elector scandal there and the election stuff there. Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator. The main piece of this I would keep an eye out for is Ken Cheeseborough is listed as a cooperator. So the reason that Trump is listed as an unindicted co-conspirator is because no one has sold him out yet.
Not yet.
So, right. So that is a complete possibility. And you have Cheeseboro, who's obviously cooperating. So if he can, he'll be, you know, basically giving them whatever the heck they want from him, right? Mark Meadows is in that bunch. Boris Epstein is the new add to it. And so I think I'm wondering how willing those folks are to protect the boss, or if they're going to try and protect their own butt, right?
Yeah, no, of the 18 that were indicted, my favorite still is Christina Bobb. Who was the election integrity operations officer at the RNC. That's the part that just cracks me up. I mean, she's the integrity person there being indicted for, well, the scheme.
Say what you want about Ronna Romney, but I feel like Christina Bobb would have been gone, you know, the second you get indicted for something election related, right? Like, I feel like that'd be like swept under the rug and be like, bye.
No, with this new RNC, it's a badge of courage, a badge of honor. This is one of those things, and I won't doubt if these people come out and you know, like Trump's been doing, you know, I'm doing this and I'm taking all the arrows so you don't have to, and you go, no, none of the arrows were coming at me. I didn't break the law.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, none of us have broken any laws, and you look at the people who have broken a lot of the laws, or were conspiring with him. They're taking most of the arrows, right? Like, maybe there's one aimed at Trump or one like loosely aimed at him, but for the most part, there's the 18 other people. And I mean, look at Jenna Ellis's statement, you know, where she's sobbing in the court because she's like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to have probation and pick up trash on the highway, you know? So, you know, I feel like this idea
they should live stream that. I got to tell you, whatever that should be their punishment. I don't think any of them are going to actually go to jail, but the punishment should be they should have to go out in the Arizona heat and pick up trash, and we get to live stream it and watch it.
Well, the thing is you would be completely within your rights because that would be public space. So you could put, you know, a live stream camera on the back of your pickup and just ride along with them. Right. So anyway,
yeah, I want to see that chain gang of Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman. I want to see those guys all chained together. Oh, please. Could I be the straw boss?
And you just wonder, too, like, are there going to be a bunch of Republican elected officials who are like, we'll figure out something for you so you don't have to pick up trash on the highway.
You ever see
but in my head, I just, you know, it's that, or they're like banging away, you know, at rocks in a cave or something, like some cartoon.
No,
or making license plates.
It made me think of just a second ago. Did you ever see Caddyshack 2 with Jackie Mason?
Yes.
You know, it's that, you know, he gets thrown out of the country. He gets thrown out of Bushwood, and then they have this sale. They're society slaves, and he buys them all up and takes them to a construction site, and they're just so far out of their league. This would be that kind of humor.
Yeah, this would be amazing. They could put them in some sort of exile and just leave them in the desert somewhere and make them figure out how to get back. I don't know. That seems sort of like a, you know, you're in trouble with your parents in the back seat kind of a punishment.
Now, the serious part of this is, you know, you've got two states who are going after these fake electors. Yeah. And gee, I don't know. Do you think it's about time? You know, what, 3.5 years later? I said the second that they put their names on that paper and they put it in and said, yeah, this is my homework. This is our stuff. The next day you go, well, closing business today, you're behind bars.
And the thing is in Michigan, they already did their investigation and then turned everything over to the Justice Department. We're like, yes, this is clearly, you know, we found all of this evidence. This is a conspiracy. Here are all the names that we found. The reason they did that is because it is a multi-state conspiracy. So technically the DOJ should be overseeing the whole thing. Well, but all of these other states have started going after them for the state crimes, the laws that they broke within the boundaries of the states, not merely the Fed stuff. So because I think we're seeing Georgia go after that, then Arizona and Michigan were like, well, hell, if they can do that, then why can't we? and they had the evidence. They have the stuff. So
yeah, we'll you've got the pieces of paper where they're saying no, those people that were certified as electors, that's not the real ones. It's us. And then trying to
pass... got you on camera, right?
No, they got the documents.
You on candy camera.
They got the documents. It's just amazing to me. And look, these were people of some bit of import. I mean, I know here in Pennsylvania, when they pulled the same scheme, the difference, the caveat, is in the ones that they signed, said in the event that the official, well, the real ones get turned down, we're going to take their place. So there's a bit of an argument that, well, they weren't really trying to pass themselves off. But these were people who were well-known Republican operatives, people who had stature in the party who put their name on this.
And those folks, like, there, it's more than one state that did where they did that, because they, I guess they had lawyers in there who were like, yeah, I'm not signing on to something that I know is going to be a crime. I don't want to go to prison for Donald Trump, right? So I wonder if these are the only states that we're going to have, or if we can see a couple of other options. But I mean, yeah. I'm cool with these. I was happy with Georgia, but this is like a little Christmas present and birthday present wrapped into one, right?
And more trouble for Rudy. I mean, you know, I got to tell you, Rudy should know better of anybody. You know, I don't know where he finished in his law class, but you know, this seems pretty simple. Don't crime.
Yeah, don't crime, and don't be bad at criming if you're going to do it, I suppose. But Rudy and his melting hair.
So I also want to get your thoughts on the immunity case in front of the Supreme Court. Trump was whining on Thursday that he could not attend because he had to be in the Manhattan courtroom. I mean, juggling his legal schedule, that's got to be difficult. But I'll tell you, one of the things that caught my attention, because I listened to the testimony, I listened to the oral arguments there, and Alito caught my attention. And he was confronted with and I forget what it was, but it was like a direct fact about the case in front. And he's like, no, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the abstract. I want to talk about anything but reality. I want to talk about anything but what this case is really about. I want to talk about oranges or whatever the abstract was. And you go, yeah, that makes about sense for what they were trying to pull off and what the entire time of listening to that stuff was. It was the Republican appointees doing backflips to try and figure out how to come to Trump's defense.
Yeah, and I think that was really the only option that they had, because this is clearly something that's against the law. They know it's against the law. They know that this is not okay. And so they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we make this seem not as bad when ultimately we have to agree that the president is not above the law, even Donald Trump. And I think, you're right with the Alito thing, where they really were just like, okay, well, what about this scenario? Or what about this? Like, they just wanted to keep coming up with different hypotheticals. And then I can't remember who, if it was, it may have been Alito, where they were like, it's Kavanaugh, who was like, I'm not really looking at this from the perspective of this case. I'm thinking about it in terms of future cases.
Yeah.
And it's like, and bless her, Ketanji Brown Jackson at the end of it really brought everything back together and said, look, I know we can sit here and talk about different hypotheticals, but this case has an actual example of it, of exactly this law being broken, these laws being broken. So if we just look at this case and acknowledge that it is not okay to break election laws as a president, and that you can't get away with this stuff, then I feel like that sort of, covers everything. If you guys want to have this theoretical conversation about, the string theory of what ifs, then by all means. But when it comes down to it, we have the examples of this already happening.
But here's what my thought was as I was listening to it. I'm going, if I'm one of those Republican appointees, if especially if I'm Kavanaugh or Gorsuch or Amy Coney Barrett, There's a way to get the Trump stink off of me. And that's to come out and go, no, look, the guy broke the law. The law is what it is. The reason that, you know, we haven't had all these kind of problems in the past is everyone feared that they would be prosecuted. There's only one guy who's entered office saying, no, I'm above the law. I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. There's only been one person to say that in the history of this country that I can figure, that I can find, and it's this guy. There is a way, I think, for those justices to go, look, we're done of Trump, and save the country.
I agree. Amy Coney Barrett in particular, I think, was probably the one justice that spoke out the most of the conservatives, where I feel like she really was making it clear that this was not okay, that nobody should be above the law. And I think you can guarantee the top three liberals, but I think Amy Coney Barrett is for sure on that, you know, presidents can't break the law and get away with it thing.
Yeah. See, I think it's going to be a 5-4 decision, clearly. And I'm going to think that they're going to find a lighter way to not give him absolute immunity, but they're going to give him a pass without letting the whole thing go crazy.
See, the thing is they've already given him a pass. I think the pass that they're giving him is delaying everything so that the case can't happen before the election.
Right.
Basically this is something that could have happened months ago, right? Like when special counsel Jack Smith asked to bypass the appeals court and say, look, you know, we know this is going to go to the Supreme Court. Why don't you guys just take it up now? And Supreme Court was like, no, really?
Maybe down the road.
Like, right, maybe. And then they had an opportunity to, the second that the appeals court put out their ruling, they could have taken it up right then, because it's not as if the lawyers for both sides hadn't already argued this and didn't already have all of their briefs and everything ready to go. Instead, they waited another 2 months before they talked about it. Now you're looking at a decision that may not come out until June. And so the gift that they have given Donald Trump is waiting and delaying as much as humanly possible. And I think that is, I think for sure there'll be five. I think the other one is going to be Chief Justice John Roberts, who probably recognizes, this might not be the best idea.
This is not the legacy I want for my Chief Justiceness.
I mean, already his legacy looks really bad. Yep. Because it's like an incredibly corrupt court. But, you know, I think that would make things look even worse if he ended up being that guy.
No, it's on his tombstone, you know, balls and strikes.
Yeah, for real. So, I mean, this dude, I think that ultimately their gift will be, okay, it's going to be a 5-4 if some miracle happens and Gorsuch is just like, I can't do this, you know, then maybe. But
so what do you think happens?
But in the end.
What do you think happens if, you know, they do wait as long as they can? And they do come back and say, no, he doesn't have immunity. What then happens? I mean, this it goes to trial, right?
Right. So the other thing that could happen is after they heard this case, they could say, you know, while we're deciding this, y'all could just go to trial or start the process over again. There's a stay right now, and the Supreme Court could dismiss the stay. But again, that's never going to happen, too, because this is the gift to Trump.
Yeah.
Waiting until June. What Judge Chutkan has said is looking at it from all of the motions that we need to deal with and all of the responses and the timeline that we have, we're looking at probably 80 days at a minimum between the time the Supreme Court gives us the ruling and when we can start the first trial date. So it may be December. Yeah. At the earliest.
Yeah. But here's the weird, what if he wins and then's found guilty?
I think that's a very interesting question. I think that would be super fun to figure out how that works, because there is a scenario. There is absolutely a scenario where, because everybody's like, oh my God, if he becomes president, he's just going to tell the Justice Department to give all of this stuff up. Well, the thing is he's not going to be president, you know, until January 20th. So they got December and January to try this guy.
Right.
And and decide what's going to happen to him. So it may very well be a thing where if he won, they could be like, oh, but you're going to spend the first couple of years of your presidency being in jail, and your vice president is going to have to work for you because you're incapacitated or whatever.
So this may be one of those.
But then there'd be another legal argument over that, right? Whether a president can go to jail, and if that qualifies as the 25th Amendment, and it's going to be just like, it will be the constitutional crisis.
See, now the weird thing about this is why I don't like lawyers. The weird thing about this, and I know all the legalese, and I listen to a lot of legal speak and a lot of double talk. You know, there's right and there's wrong. And I think average Americans are looking at this going, there's right and there's wrong. If he did what he's accused of doing, which is, you know, getting all these fake electors to try and undermine the actual process, if he did bring all those people on January 6th to the Capitol to cause the chaos and the riot that happened just to hold off the certification of the vote, if he did these things, it's a black and white right or wrong thing. All of this legalese, all of this, you know, mental gymnastics, this is what I think, you know, most people are tired of. There's right or wrong. I see this as a guy's wrong.
Yeah, no. I think you're spot on. And I think that is the one piece that will, even if he doesn't go to trial in before November, that most Americans will be like, what the hell? You know, this is an easy decision. And even if it doesn't go to trial, we're still going to have tons of very public fights. And there's going to be reporters in the courtroom live tweeting everything that's happening. So it's not like this is just going to disappear into the ether somewhere. There's still going to be motions and arguments and yada, yada, yada going on. So, and the other thing is Liz Cheney had an op-ed this week where she basically said, look, Jack Smith has found a heck of a lot more evidence than what we had when we did the congressional hearings. So I think Americans are just going to be like, oh, tell me more, right? Like everybody's going to be super interested.
No, I hope so, because I got to tell you, I fear, and we just spoke with Reed Galen a little bit ago, and he said, look, I'm not seeing this getting in the local newspapers. I hope you're right. I hope this is filtering down. I hope people are paying attention. I hope we haven't gotten so tired of this that this has sucked so much oxygen out of the room that we're just not paying attention to it. I hope we are.
I think so, just based on what is trending on all of the social media, right? Like, this isn't just a Twitter conversation. Everybody's talking about this. That is a non-political person on Facebook that I follow. Everyone's talking about this on Threads. This is not something that is just sort of disappearing. The idea that Michael Cohen said to David Pecker in the Manhattan trial this week, I don't worry about it. Jeff Sessions is going to let Trump do whatever he needs to. You'll be taken care of, right? Like, this is a level of corruption that I think folks are now remembering from what it was like living in the Trump era.
Yep.
And hopefully folks are just like, God, I do not want to go back to that. I don't want to live like that.
He's running on Project 2025 and Schedule F and all of the, he's telegraphing his punches. He's telling us what he is going to do. I don't know how else to put that.
And oh my God, Mark Esper was on CNN this week talking to Jake Tapper and goes, look, this is so hypothetical. None of this stuff is going to happen with this whole, like, Trump could lead a military coup. And I'm like, what world are you living in, Mark Esper? You have former generals talking about this guy being incredibly dangerous. How are you not understanding yep. the power of the presidency to pardon whoever he wants? And the power to fire via tweet, which is what happened to Esper, right? Anybody who he wants, so he can put in the loyalists who will protect him the way that they didn't do
yep.
in the first administration.
And you've got you've got an entire think tank circle, a whole network who are behind this now as where they weren't before. They're not going to let this opportunity go to waste. That's just how it is. But Sarah, as always, appreciate the expertise, the knowledge, the input, and the humor. Always great talking with you.
My pleasure. Have an awesome weekend.
You as well. Our good friend Sarah Burris. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Are you paying attention? That's the question. Or have you gotten so tired of it that you just want the pain to stop? I want to hear. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day the AFL-CIO held a Jobs Now rally in Washington, D.C. A painful recession had pushed unemployment in the U.S. to 9%. Many workers across the nation thought the Ford administration was not doing enough to address the needs of working families. 60,000 people, many of them union members carrying banners representing their unions, gathered in RFK Stadium. There they heard speeches, including one from Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, who had served as vice president under Lyndon B. Johnson. His speech described the devastating impact of unemployment. Senator Humphrey said, "Our nation must recommit itself to the goal and the promise of full employment, a job for every American who is willing and able to work. Perhaps we would get bolder action and more compassion from this administration if some of its top advisors had a little taste of unemployment themselves. Perhaps they would know what unemployment is. It's drawing your last unemployment check with no job in sight. It's sitting in the dark to save on the light bill. It's making shoes last another month and driving on bald tires. It's eating a little less so the kids can eat a little more. It's facing eviction because you can't pay the rent or meet the mortgage. It's borrowing from your brother-in-law or letting your insurance lapse. It's facing yourself in the mirror and asking why and how much longer. It's wondering how a nation this rich, this enterprising, this great can let more than 8 million Americans who want to work and need to work go without work." Some protesters rushed the stage at the rally, causing it to end early. But his questions still remain. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I got to tell you, I hope Sarah's right. I hope people are paying attention. I hope folks are paying attention to their local news, that they're watching what's going on. I'm hoping that's the reality. Because the only way that we're going to get out of this mess is for we the people to find a way together to put this constitutional crisis moment that we're in behind us, learn the lessons, move forward. There's a lot here. And like I said, I think the three Trump nominees, the three Trump justices could, quite frankly, get the stink off of them by going, look, he broke the law. He doesn't have, no one has this kind of immunity. We'll see. We will see. I want to finish today off with a quick email. Mike in California sent me an email from Santa Cruz, California, a member of Teamsters Local 210, sent me an email, said, "Hey, do you support a 32-hour work week and paid for 48 a la Bernie Sanders?" He says, "I think a three-day weekend would be great. I would use less gas and the company would use less energy as well." He pointed out to me that a friend of his went through it in the private sector with a 32-hour work week, and the company closed. Now, he said, "I don't know why. I'm not sure why they closed. They just closed." I don't know that it had anything to do with the 32-hour work week. But you know, to be honest, you know, the eight-hour day is gone. The 40-hour work week is a construct of labor law from over 80 years. And it's a push that's well over 100 years old. You know, we're fighting for the 8-hour day, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will from 100 years ago. It's what they were fighting for. And very little has changed from that call. So all the technological advancements, all of the things that that have made us more productive seems to end up in the hands of the few instead of everyone else. So it seems to me a way forward, especially with automation and with all the robotics and stuff coming up. A path. Now, do I support a 32-hour work week? Yeah, absolutely. There's your answer. Yes. If you missed any of today's program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you get the audio. FreeSpeech.org for the video. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at RickSmithShow.com. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.